Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Okay, so welcome back to the Build Conference. This is Evan Basilik here for the Azure Networking Podcast. We are on yet another live show here at Build in Seattle 2018. I'm here with Russell Young, Mark Bloodworth, and we're here with our special guest, Jeff Holland. We've had 3 days of super lots of stuff. We've done a bunch of shows, been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We surely still have some new announcements, though.
Well, I'm sure there are some, and I'm sure Mark's going to talk a little bit about Cognitive Services Labs in a bit. But I just wanted to kind of, since we're at Build and it's the last one, I think one of the things that we haven't talked about was one of the partnerships that got announced, which was with DJI.
Make
the drones. So these lovely flying drones, which I'd love to get one, but I've got no excuse to go and buy one in there.
That's a hint to all the audience. If anybody's got a drone they want to ship us.
Christmas is too far away, but anyway. Yeah. But the great thing, so there was a demo on stage in one of the keynotes, and it was demoing the IoT Edge functionality, so actually running some of our cognitive services and the Vision API on the DJI itself, so on board. And they had it hovering over some pipe work, and it was identifying anomalies.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
And then those things were coming up and highlighted on the video in real time with a white or yellow box around it to show anomalies. So really interesting. And the Qualcomm one, again, another partnership. And they produced these lovely little IoT cameras. And it was a pretty similar demo. So that you could go off and train the model up in Azure. I can't remember what the tool's called to do that. Do you remember what that
is? The one that we showed was like the custom vision service where you can like upload sample images. The one that powered the pipe one was just a custom one that they had built. So had taken a bunch of sample images and then they trained it to detect anomalies.
So I come out of a manufacturing world, right, where when people are doing that kind of maintenance, I mean, people die doing some of that maintenance, right? Climbing up on these high areas or going down into confined spaces and stuff, right? The thought of being able to push these drones with some of the custom vision capabilities out to do that, that's awesome.
Yeah,
I mean, it really
climbing
is.
Ladders and hanging off harnesses and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that, I guess. But yeah.
No, absolutely.
So it's nice. I mean, you train the model, you download the model, and then you can go and push it out on containers to these devices, and off they go, and they go off and run it.
Yeah, because it's actually running on the device at that point.
That's the edge.
So speaking of custom vision, which is one of the cognitive services, there's also been a bunch of new labs that have been announced while we've been here at Build. So I just wanted to draw attention to those. There's about six of them. You can go and find them on the announcements page for cognitive services. There's one called Project Answer Search, so you can enhance user search experience. There's URL Preview, which Russell and I were just talking about before we started to record this show.
Sounds great. So that's about, I think you put in a URL and it will go off and discover some highlights about the page that you're looking at and warn you if there's any sort of adult content on there and that sort of thing. So I'm guessing it's for building snippets to build into your own applications.
Yeah, so and then there's Project Anomaly Finder, so you can look at your data over time, detect anomalies. So in the same way that you can detect anomalies in vision, this is looking at your own data.
That one's awesome, actually. So I think App Insights and the analytics behind that already uses some of that stuff in the background for detecting those kinds of things, so looking for patterns. Makes your debugging really easy.
That's very cool. I didn't really. So that's now a service. I didn't even know that was its own service now in Cognitive, because I've used the App Insights one, where you can see like, oh, hey, we can tell at 3 o'clock p.m. there was an anomaly, and it like highlights it and clicks it. This is now its own standalone cognitive service?
Project Anomaly Finder. It's a lab. It's a lab at the moment.
That's super cool.
The great thing is it will look at all the detail it has to do with that exception and compare it with other ones, and then it will say, oh, actually, the thing that's different about this one was customer name or something like that. So you can then focus right down. It saves you hours of debugging.
That's awesome.
Then there's a couple of sort of chat-related ones. There's one called Project Conversation Learner to build and teach conversation interfaces, and one called Project Personality Chat. These are available by invitation. It will be soon. To make intelligent agents more complete and conversational by handling common small talk is something that obviously bot interfaces tend not to be able to do. So that's really interesting as well.
This one's funny because my wife gives me a hard time because the IT industry is not known for our strong ability to interact interpersonally as a whole, right? And I'm just thinking about this bot. I'm thinking there's some coworkers I've had over the years that the bot probably has more personality at that point and more social abilities than some of my coworkers over
as
the years.
You're talking about me,
I swear it's not you, Russell.
In a few weeks, shows up, you see a little earpiece in his ear, and you're like, he's so much more personable now. Like, what's changed? That's right.
He asked me about the things I was interested in. And then Project Things Analysis, the last one, which I think we saw some aspects of in the keynotes. So you can do digital ink recognition and layout analysis through API. So lots of really interesting new services coming to Cognitive Services. You know, there's already a bunch of stuff you can take advantage of, and it's great to see that they continue to be developed.
It's awesome. It's awesome. Great. Well, you know, so without any further ado, so Jeff, why don't you introduce yourself, tell us what you do, you know, at Microsoft, what your passions are, and kind of what your focus is.
Absolutely. First off, very excited to be here, so thanks so much. I'm Jeff Holland. I'm a senior program manager in Azure right now, and I focus on Azure Serverless. So spend a lot of time with Azure Functions, Azure Logic Apps, Azure Event Grid, kind of these different components in Azure that lets developers build and deploy serverless apps. So had a bunch of fun this week at Build, talking about some of the new capabilities that we have, some that we're working on. Had the chance to show some of that off during Scott's keynote as well. Stuff around IoT as well, what we were just talking about, and running some of this functionality both, you know, at massive scale in the cloud or on IoT devices when that
So you're actually pushing your serverless stuff. Some we were talking about the cognitive stuff pushing to the devices. You're also pushing serverless out to these functions or to these devices as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Cool.
So tell us a bit more about your demo on the keynote, because that was quite impressive.
Yeah,
the
it was a lot of fun.
As well, the time scales was great.
Yeah, the big thing was the minutes thing. So the challenge was we were trying to showcase how to build an IoT app. And I think the message we really wanted to get across was anybody can do this. Like, this isn't, you don't have to go get a degree to know how to build an IoT app. So Scott had a challenge where he's like, I want to see if you can build an IoT app from scratch in less than 5 minutes, because you've only got a 5 minute demo. So I took that quite literally, and so I had them put a timer on the board, and within 5 minutes, we created a brand new Azure function to run some code whenever a button was pressed. We made it so that that code could then trigger a Logic App to post a tweet to Twitter, and so before the 5 minutes was up, now once I pushed this IoT button, a tweet got sent out that said, hey, you know, this is all up and ready to go, and I was telling, I love the timer aspect. I think it added some suspense. Yeah, I really wanted like a rope with like a fuse that was slowly ticking down too, and there was a big blade that was going to drop down just to add some more excitement.
PR nicks that
they
one.
Said apparently
one.
There's liability or something. But so that was fun.
And those buttons, I think they nice little standalone. Are they Wi-Fi buttons or something?
Yeah,
like
they're Wi-Fi. These ones are
really
Wi-Fi.
Cool.
Yeah.
Some of the attendees at Build lucky enough to get in the queue, and I think we gave away, 1,000 of them or something?
Yeah,
like
we
that.
Had 1,000 of them. I wish we would have had more. I think we wanted more.
Yeah, I didn't get one.
I know.
Where's our button?
This is why you brought me on here. Yeah, you just wanted like to read.
We were
like,
at the back of the
guy.
Line. So.
This is the button guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really great. Cool. So did you have time to spare? Or
there
was
a minute and a little bit to spare. And that said, though, like I did already have my IoT hub in Azure set up ahead of time. And so I specifically left time to spare so that anybody's like, hold on, you had some of this stuff done ahead. It's like, there was some cushion there. I just didn't want to bore you by watching me deploy resources.
Yeah. Click a button and we wait 30 seconds
exactly.
for a deploy.
And then
I'd
get to tell jokes, so we went that way. But the interesting
That's
thing
That's amazing that you can do that in that time frame to have a functional app that is leveraging an IoT device at that point. That's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it was live, you know, we should also add that. That tweet did go out to Twitter. It was,
right.
It was no smoke and mirrors, that went out.
Yeah.
All the code I typed live, there were no macros or people behind the scenes making it look good. So it was fun. And then the second part that we did related to this IoT stuff is, you know, these are these cloud applications and you can use serverless, which is awesome because, like, let's say you now have 10,000 buttons. That same app that I wrote in 5 minutes can now scale to 10,000 buttons all getting pressed.
Yeah.
But there are some times where you do want this compute running on the IoT edge. And so the second part of the demo was, hey, let's make it so that instead of pushing a button, what if the device itself could actually look at things and know whether or not it should send a tweet? So we had a Raspberry Pi that we were running some machine learning on that could identify images of Scott Guthrie.
This is the Scott or Not.
The Scott or Not app.
Yeah.
That's right.
Cool.
And as soon as the camera recognized Scott, It saw them right away, and then it sent another tweet too.
So that's the model being deployed again directly to the Pi. So
that's
very
right.
much like what we said with the DJI drone, except this one recognizes Scott Guthrie rather than recognizing an anomaly in a bit of pipe. But it's the same basic concept.
Exactly that. And in fact, like, because last year was when Microsoft kind of came out with this whole IoT edge thing. And even for me at the time, it felt very abstract. I think over the last year, it's really solidified, especially around some of these ML things. Because if you think about, like, voice detection or vision detection, it doesn't make a lot of sense both for, like, privacy concerns and latency concerns.
Yeah, it'd always be shipping it back. It doesn't.
Tons of data going back and forth. Yeah. So if instead I can do that detection right on the device itself, it scales a little bit nicer that way and is really performant. So that's where we're really kind of doubling down on this edge story of you can do a lot of that compute power just right there on the drone or on the Raspberry Pi or on your, you know, whatever it is.
So this may end up getting too wonky for us to get super deep in, but, you know, these services that are running in Azure to do, you know, functions and whatnot, right? These are non-trivial services. How much design work did you guys have to do as an engineering team to figure out how to get this stuff to be able to run on these, relatively speaking, very small devices with a lot less resources?
Yeah,
I mean, it's functionally the same code, no pun intended, but it's not like it's a totally rewritten thing. I mean, this is the same stuff that's running up in the cloud, just at a smaller scale.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what makes it nice is kind of for at least all the serverless services, don't say that 10 times fast, but even the machine learning ones, there's kind of two components. There's the part that actually runs your code or the runtime, and then there's the whole scaling and provisioning and all of that logic.
Yep.
For something like Azure Functions, those are actually two very separate things. Like, we have our Azure Functions runtime, and then there's all the magic that makes it so we can scale out and process 10,000 events. To run it on the edge, it did take some work, but all we really had to do was say, hey, what if we could just pull out this one piece and let people run it wherever they want?
Because you don't care about provisioning. Because
you don't have to scale
it.
Like, it's only on its one device.
Right.
You never have to, like, scale out or scale in. So there's still that piece behind the scenes if you want to leverage it, but yanking that out. And it's the same for the custom vision. Like, they have all this stuff that lets you train these models, and that gets pretty
complex.
You don't
need that because your model's already there.
You just export that model piece that you've already done.
Okay. So it's not so much that you had to kind of rewrite it from scratch. It's that you cut out the stuff that you don't need
for
the real-time stuff on the device.
Yep.
I hadn't thought about it that way. That's great.
Which is one of the differences with something like Azure Stack. Because Azure Stack very much is like, you want the whole thing, all of the pieces, which is why those are massive, you know, data center type things, not something that you can run, you know, Azure Functions scale out on a Raspberry Pi, but we just trim out that little piece.
Right.
So what's new in serverless world then? What's the kind of thing that you're working on at the moment or focusing on?
So one of the big emphasis with serverless is, I think the whole goal of serverless is, like, we want people to just be able to write their code and not have to think about what they usually have to worry about when building cloud applications, like complexity around how am I going to host this thing, patch this thing, scale this thing out. What we've really been focusing on lately is making sure that that's accessible to every developer from every language. So when we first released Azure Functions, the current version that's kind of generally available, it could run a few languages, C#, JavaScript, but it was pretty confined to those languages and how we ran them. We've re-architected the entire Azure Function runtime so that it actually runs in these little modular components or workers. So we can execute very flexibly different languages, talk to different runtimes. So we showed this week how you can now have Python running for some of your Azure Functions, and you can have Java, and you can have JavaScript, and you can have C#, and we can version all of that independently, kind of just trying to take this idea of, hey, I might want to use serverless, but maybe I want to use this version of JavaScript, or I want to use this version of Cosmos DB. We've broken it out in a way to make that very flexible.
Right.
And then the other piece, whether or not we want to go into it or not, is a thing called durable functions, which is a way...
I saw that. That seemed like you're adding state to these a little bit.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, some durability. Functions are very ephemeral, short-lived. Like, you call it, it does its thing, and it disappears.
Yep.
But business processes aren't usually as short-lived as that. You might have processing an order where you've got to do a few steps, maybe wait until the package gets delivered before you finally close the order.
Yep.
And durable functions is a programming extension to functions where you can now describe those more long-running stateful processes, but still keep it in a serverless realm. And we can go more into that, because I know, like, that sounds, it's like, wait, so what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, how does that compare to, say, doing the same kind of function flow within Logic Apps, but calling two or three different functions instead of one function that's durable?
Yep. They are very, very similar.
Right.
In differences, too. So Logic Apps, where it really shines, is you get this nice visual designer, and then you get like the 230 connectors out of the box. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing something that's around integration or kind of integration workflows, Logic Apps is your sweet spot. Durable Functions focuses a lot on a code-first experience. So there's already some developers who, and I worked on Logic Apps heavily in the past before doing Functions. There were some people who were like, I like Logic Apps, but I don't want to be doing this whole GUI thing. Like, for whatever reason, they just cringe. I'm a real developer. I need to be writing in code. So Durable lets you have the flexibility to do it in code, but there's also some patterns that aren't necessarily perfect for Logic Apps that are great with Durable. So one that I like to use, because it's fairly common, is we were working with a customer, and they had, every night, they would get these batch spreadsheets that had every single order that happened during the day. So it was like 100,000 rows. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to process all of those rows. And they came to me and they're like, look, the problem is when we start off a function, if we try to go through all 100,000 rows, we hit our timeout. Like, it's going to take us 6 hours to process this whole spreadsheet. But we want to do this with serverless. It's not necessarily about calling function one, then function two. It's just we've got this really long-running thing. We need to kind of maintain some state in this process. So what Durable lets you do is actually say, okay, I'm going to take the spreadsheet, but then split it up into smaller tasks, like one task per row. Then it can actually execute all of those tasks independently, know when all 100,000 rows have been completed, and then do some kind of aggregation at the end. So the whole process may take an hour, but we're able to maintain the state and understand that, hey, I'm going to split this up into 100,000 smaller functions, but I still want to manage this as just my nightly order processing thing. So that's what Durable kind of lets you do, which is a little bit different than what Logic Apps is going for in terms of creating integration workflows, connecting the dots.
And in that example, do you have control over how parallel the functions go? Do you say what the limits are in terms of scale?
Yeah, so for right now, you write that orchestration in C#, and it uses just the task piece of C#. So you can create like task.whenAll, task.whenAny. You could write a for each loop, and you could, or you could write a for loop, and you can decide your degree of parallelism. So you can write whatever you want in code, and it will honor that. So you can kind of control how parallel you want that to get, or maybe you do want to do only five at a time.
Russell, when you're asking about that, I mean, what whatever in that kind of model where we're talking about serverless, where would you ever want to reduce the parallelism? Or is that, because I'm trying to think about, like, if I think about serverless, I don't have any resources. I'm just saying I want this code to run, and I want to process this spreadsheet. And maybe, let me flip the question around. They had all these jobs that would take, you know, 6 hours or whatever. Why wouldn't we, as the service, just scale out and say, well, I'm going to run this on 1,000 in parallel, and now it takes a minute instead of 1,000 minutes. Like, is that a decision we make from a design perspective at the platform level?
I'll tell you exactly why it comes up. Okay. And it's fairly common, because usually a solution isn't 100% serverless. So the one I hear, even this conference a lot, is, I love Azure Functions. I wrote this really cool function, so whenever an event happens, I'm going to transform the data and stick it in a database. Mm-hmm. But the database is something like SQL Server, which is not serverless.
Right.
And so they get really excited, and function scales out really fast, and now they have all these events, and then SQL Server's screaming in the corner being like, hey, that's great, functions that you scale so fast, but you're tipping me over. So the reason that we need to give control is, like, if every single one of those line items has to go pull something from SQL and pop it back in, if we don't give you those knobs to control just how fast we do it, we can end up tipping your other stuff over. And, like, I love to flex our muscles and be like, yes, Azure Functions can, you know, scale out super rapidly. But they're usually, or often enough, are other systems you have downstream that can't handle
that makes a lot of sense. So it's not so much that you're doing anything at the functions layer that you need to protect against, because that's built into the concept of the service, but it's that your other tiers behind it may not have this infinite scale.
Exactly.
So
that.
So in other words, these other services haven't caught up to you.
I didn't say it. No. Yeah.
I'm going to get nasty grams from the SQL team. You said we couldn't keep up with functions.
Yeah, I guess concurrency on the database is going to be an issue, isn't it, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, databases are great, but the reality is the whole point of a database is I have one master copy of my data.
Yeah.
Right? And so, the scale out concept has never worked great in the database world, even in the NoSQL world, right? Because you have to eventually have consistency somewhere, so you can't just infinitely go out and have them, because then your consistency takes forever to arrive. So yeah, so there's always a scale problem there.
Okay. The other service you mentioned earlier was Event Grid.
Event Grid, that's right.
So you're doing a lot in there as well?
Yes, and that's the newer one. That's the one where, like, when I do a session and I say, you know, how many people have done Azure Functions? Maybe, like, half the room will raise their hand. Logic Apps, it's about the same. Event Grid, it's usually just a handful.
Yeah.
In many ways, because it is one of those things that just runs behind the scenes so you don't have to think about. Almost like if you said, how many people here use Azure Networking? It's like, well, I don't know. Do I? Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, you absolutely are. You might just not know that you are.
Yeah.
And so Event Grid is a serverless eventing service specifically aimed at routing events from other resources in Azure or within your own application to other serverless components. So the way that I like to explain it, because one of the challenges with naming in general is it's like we've got Event Grid, we've got event hubs, we've got queues, we've got topics. What do I do here? If you think about like a traditional queue, like if I'm sending you a letter and the letter gets to the post office, if it's a traditional queue, you have to leave your house, go to the post office, say,
up.
Is there any mail for me? They'll be like, yes, here's one letter from Jeff. You get that mail and you go back home.
Yeah.
It's possible that you only go to the post office once a day. There might be a long period of time where that letter's sitting there idle. Event Grid's whole model, it's very much aimed towards these serverless architectures where it will come to your door and knock and say, there's a message for you right now. Which is great for something like functions, because functions are stateless, they're not there all of the time. So if we can get notified, hey, there's an event for you, spin up and run, then that's exactly what Event Grid does. So it's
event-driven, like in the same sense that when you're used to programming, say, a Windows form, you press a button, it's the same kind of understanding.
Exactly that. Like, you would set up an event handler, and then you have your different, like, on-button-click event, and then you write your code that says, this is what I want to do, and it just lets it know. It's that concept,
but in the cloud. So, on-message shows up, kickoff function call at that point. So,
so with message queues, though, it's kind of storing it, and then you're collecting it. What if the subscriber isn't there, if you're not home, right?
And there are, so Event Grid does have some stuff built in. They'll have what is called exponential backoff. So let's say it comes and knocks on your door, and for whatever reason it's down or not available. They'll try again in 5 minutes, and if you still don't answer, they'll try again in 10 for up to 24 hours. They'll keep kind of like coming back. And if all of those fail, then they will stick it in a dead letter queue so that you can go back to it later. But there are, that said, there are still times where you may want the flexibility and the power that something like queues bring to have, like, you know, dead lettering queues or retry policies, or like, I want full control over how quickly I'm going to be dequeuing these messages. So I definitely don't think that Event Grid is like a replacement to some of these traditional messaging formats. It's just a different flavor that's optimized for a different set of scenarios. In the same way that like an event handler in a Windows application doesn't replace the need for queues in other parts.
Right. Yeah.
But for
right.
that specific use case, it's perfect.
Yeah,
cool. No, that's great. No, I mean, Jeff, anything else that we haven't hit on in the functions in the serverless space that you want to highlight?
This is pretty, I mean, the only other big thing, it's not necessarily news, but for me personally, the big piece that's made a big difference is just the tooling updates and supports. So when I first tried to write my first Azure function, even before I was on the Azure Functions team, it was an okay experience, but I wasn't blown away. Like, I didn't have IntelliSense, like it felt a little bit awkward. In the last 6 months, even across Visual Studio Code, Visual Studio, even tools like IntelliJ, we've built some really rich and powerful tools. To now, I would say, like, if you haven't tried out serverless functions and written them in that local editor, it's really worth giving that a shot, because it does feel just like writing a console application. But now when you're done, you can just publish it and run it whenever you want, have it be hosted in the cloud, and everything's just taken care of. So
it's totally like writing any of the code now, isn't it? I mean, when you go back to that first experience, as you say, it felt different. There were some constraints. It was almost like kind of, this is how it will work, and you get a vision of the future, whereas now it's just first-class citizen.
Yes, exactly that. Like, it was C-sharp scripts. It, like, pulling in dependencies was awkward, but now it feels just like, there are even sometimes, I always feel like there's always these little things where I have to write a quick console application to just do something. It's just as easy for me now to just do that in a function or a console app. Yeah. They feel very the same, which I like. Like, yes. It's just like, just let me do what I'm used to doing. Let me use the tools I'm used to using. And if I want this to now run 1,000 times or one time, that's all taken care of. So that would be the other big area that we're really pushing in on now, too.
Yeah. I think we were talking the other day, weren't we, about the DevOps process. In the early version, it felt disjointed and a little bit tricky to manage all these functions. And why would I want to split stuff up? I could use web jobs anyway and just extend my web job. But you're saying that's all gone now and it's pretty much the DevOps process.
It's a journey, like especially around some of these things like DevOps. Yeah. Even just barely, I was just talking to the Visual Studio team, services team. There's still areas to improve, and microservices all up. Like that's the big trade-off you get here. And I've even heard people talk about serverless, and I'm hesitant to say the word nanoservices, because they're just these really bite-sized pieces. Yep. And the big trade-off is there, like, now I have this big box of pieces. How do I make sure I'm managing this thing in a cohesive way? Yep. We have tools that are starting to go there across the dev tooling, VSTS, and now App Insights integration, but I am not satisfied. Like, I really do want it to be super seamless for anybody to manage a complex system. And there still is some, like, you kind of have to consciously design your system now in a way where you don't lose track of pieces to know when to call them. So we're getting there.
Sounds like we need to put him and Donovan and Jessica and Damien in a room and see what they come up with.
That's exactly right.
Because that sounds like
lock
the right
set. Lock the door, set the timer, start that fuse.
Five minutes.
We might need 5 days on that one.
That's great. Awesome. Well, any last questions for Jeff?
No, I don't think so. That's been great. Thank you.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you very much,
Jeff.
We'll put some of the links on the site, and I appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.